We talk about healthcare a lot in our country. With our country getting steadily older and sicker, we need to. And all that dust up over the Affordable Care Act, which we're also still talking about, did not extend health insurance to every single American. So there are ongoing efforts to make that happen and to improve health overall. The Trust for America's Health is a nonpartisan advocate for, well, for America's health. It's out with a new report today, laying some approaches to policy that could improve health for many people. Adam Lustig is Senior Policy Development Manager at the Trust for America's Health and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Hi, Adam. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thank you for having me today.
It's good to have you. Is it fair to say that Trust for America's Health is focused less on the delivery of healthcare itself than on going back a little further into some of the fundamentals that make overall health maintenance easier?
Absolutely. While we recognize the importance of access to high-quality healthcare, which we do address in the report that you mentioned, there is a significant amount of an individual's health, about 80%, that's actually made up of non-clinical things. So thinking about someone's economic status, thinking about their social status, thinking about opportunities to have affordable housing and have access to high-quality education. These are all things that have a significant impact on individuals and communities' health.
And the report out today is called Leveraging Evidence-Based Policies to Improve Health, Control Costs, and Create Health Equity. So you're setting a fairly broad task there.
Yes, we are. So in our report, we address five large buckets in the report, really recognizing just that the interplay and interconnectedness of all of the things that we focus on a day-to-day basis, whether that's where we live, where we work, where we play and enjoy our fellow community members. These are all things that really impact community's health.
So the first of the five buckets would appear to be access to high-quality healthcare services. I know that the Trust for America's Health applauded the survival of Obamacare in the Supreme Court this year, but what else needs to happen to get the millions of people who do not have health insurance covered?
So right now there are still 12 states that have yet to expand Medicaid, and so this is something that's a critical issue that would give millions of individuals access to health insurance and health care services. In the report, we also highlight some more, I'd say, detailed programs. So expanding access to home visiting programs. And these are programs that are typically focused on pregnant women to ensure that they're getting appropriate prenatal and postnatal care, as well as their children once they're born. And then we also highlight the importance of community health workers, which are typically lay individuals who are community members that act as guides to their fellow community members to help them ensure that they are accessing the high-quality health services that they are able to.
Did the pandemic point up some further deficiencies in access to high-quality health care services?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the COVID-19 pandemic has really shone a light on a number of inequities that we see in our country. I would say that's not solely focused on the healthcare system, but I think we've really seen that, especially in the economic and housing space as well.
Now, in terms of getting coverage to everyone, I mean, this is not something that can be dealt with at the federal level, it would appear, given the current composition of Congress. So are you working state by state to convince the people in each capital to consider the Medicaid expansion?
What we do as a nonpartisan organization is really try to present the evidence that has been developed. And when it comes to Medicaid expansion, there is a very robust evidence base of over 400 studies that have shown not only the health improvements that result from expanding Medicaid, but actually some of the economic benefits of expanding Medicaid. Not only does it benefit state governments by improving their coffers, since they are receiving a significant amount of federal funds, and that was actually and those incentives have been increased in the recent American Recovery Plan Act that was passed by Congress a few months ago. But also the financial standing of individuals, since they now are able to afford health care, and so would allow them to stay in their jobs without having to worry about the financial implications of getting sick, and also impacts financial hospital standing. And this, I think, is something that is critical, especially in rural areas where we've seen a lot of rural hospitals closing due to the financial difficulties that they've been facing.
So it sounds like you've given lots of reasons for states to go ahead and join the Medicaid expansion. Is it more of a political thing that you find that causes the resistance state by state?
At the moment, a lot of it is driven by politics. However, a lot of the concerns are related to the economic concerns with expanding Medicaid. So as the Medicaid expansion works, the federal government provides a high percentage match for the cost of those expanded individuals. However, those costs, that percentage match lowers over time. However, the economic benefit of this expansion really makes up for that drop in federal funding. And so that's something that we really try to lift up and make people realize that this is really a win-win. It benefits the health of individuals and communities, and it can benefit the economy as a whole.
Adam Lustig is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Senior Policy Development Manager at Trust for America's Health, which is out with a report today indicating some pathways to providing greater health care and greater health care availability to more Americans with five different pots, of which we've discussed one. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your questions and comments, or send them by email to jx@jeffnet.org. So bucket number two is economic mobility, and this means, you know, upward, you know, being able to make more money over time, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And so for the policies we focus on here, they do tend to focus on individuals who may be working in lower income type positions. And so we focus on three policies here. One is the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a tax credit that is available at the federal level, and many states across the country do offer a state level Earned Income Tax Credit, including Oregon, which has a 12% of the federal match, and they make it fully refundable. So if someone is able to have enough tax liability that's actually greater than what they would owe, they would actually get that money back. And there's a tremendous amount of research that really supports that the health impact that can have, because those individuals are now able to utilize those funds to either make necessary purchases or able to get much-needed health care. We also highlight living wage. And so this can take its shape in many forms. And so there's a very complex calculation for what would make up a living wage, but also just increasing the minimum wage as a whole. And I know in Oregon that the current minimum wage is $12.75 an hour. And something that I was really excited to see is that after 2023, the minimum wage in Oregon is actually adjusted to the CPI. And so this essentially is acknowledging that as inflation increases, the minimum wage should come along with that. And so that's a really great and progressive policy. And then the last policy we have in this promoting economic mobility bucket is related to paid sick and family leave, which Oregon does offer within the state. And so this is an area that we've really seen a critical need for during the COVID-19 pandemic, as especially frontline workers who may be concerned that they may have been exposed to COVID-19. For many of them, they do not have access to this much needed benefit. And so they really have to make the decision, do I continue to go into work, or do I risk potentially either getting fired or losing some of my wages to ensure that they are protecting their own health and the health of their families and the health of their community?
So that's the economic mobility portion of things. Let's move on to the third bucket, which is affordable housing. And here again, clearly what you're talking about at Trust for America's Health is not just healthcare itself, doctors, medicines, hospitals, but also the things in your life that can add to your general well-being.
Absolutely. And so having a safe and stable home is something that's really critical to an individual's health. And so in this bucket related to affordable housing, we highlight three policies. The first is the low-income housing tax credit. And this is actually a tax credit that is focused on at developers, where when they are developing a new property, they would save a certain percentage of the units within that property to be for low or moderate income families. And so this is really critical to ensuring that individuals can live in neighborhoods where they may not necessarily have been able to afford them in the past. And this is something we see a lot in large urban areas, which tend to have a much higher rent than some more rural areas. We also highlight housing choice vouchers. And so this is a federal program. It's also known, or previously known, as Section 8. And so this essentially gives money to individuals directly so that they are able to pay rent. And again, this is really critical in urban and expensive areas where they typically may not be able to afford to live in some specific neighborhoods. And then finally, we have legal supports for tenants and eviction proceedings. So a lot of people may not be aware, but since eviction proceedings in the court that it takes place is not in a criminal court, that individuals do not have access to legal representation or guaranteed that access. And so often when someone is facing eviction, they're often in a dire financial situation, and a landlord will show up with his or her representation, and the tenant themselves will not have any representation. So they're more than likely to lose that case. And so this is something that we've seen growing interest in specific states and specific localities to ensure that individuals can have that adequate representation when facing eviction.
Adam Lustig, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Senior Policy Development Manager at TIFA, Trust for America's Health, talking about a new report out today, leveraging evidence-based policies to improve health, control costs, and create health equity. And obviously, we're getting far afield from specific medical practices and procedures and into the parts of your life that can add to your health overall. So you can join the conversation on the Exchange as we continue through the list, 800-838-3760, with your comments and questions by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let me come back to affordable housing for just a second, Adam. Is this one of the toughest nuts to crack? It seems like all the efforts to provide affordable housing run up against a lot of rocks and a lot of housing, particularly in our part of the world where real estate is expensive, becomes market rate pretty quickly.
Yes, it does. And this is something that is a very difficult nut to crack. I think there's numerous aspects to it. I think one in which is just the funding available as a whole. And so even though housing choice vouchers do provide money to individuals to be able to afford rent, there's a significant wait list for that program. And so there are many people across the country who are waiting for that support but are unable to get it. And then just especially in urban locales, and just like you, I live just outside of Washington, D.C., and it's a very expensive housing market. And so it's very difficult for developers to find that right balance between how do I ensure that I'm making enough money on my property, but also ensuring that they are saving a certain number of units for individuals of all different types of income brackets to be able to afford to live there. And so that's really the role of the low-income housing tax credit. Over the next few years, the tax credits and their affordability aspect will actually be phasing out over time. So that's something that we are really emphasizing to ensure that these credits are continuing to be available for developers to ensure that that housing is available for all.
Let's move on to the fourth bucket of five in the report out today, and that is learning environments for children. I mean, are we talking for all ages, or is there a particular emphasis on one group?
So this is pretty broad. So we have one policy that's specifically focused on early childhood. And so this is increasing access to high quality early childhood education programs. And so this could be pre-K, it could be Head Start or other similar programs that may be in child care centers or home-based centers. And really thinking about who has access to high-quality early childhood education. And the disparities are quite clear in terms of those with lower incomes are unable to afford this high-quality education. So I was just looking up statistics before our call, and I saw just 25% of Oregon children are enrolled in a publicly funded early childhood education program. And so there's a significant number of lower-income families that are unable to afford a high-quality program. And so ensuring that everyone can have access to these programs is very important because the evidence has shown not only the near-term impacts of having high-quality early childhood education, and so that's really focused on being ready to enter kindergarten and primary school, but also the longer-term impacts. So it impacts high school graduation rates and actually impacts those children's health later in life as well.
So make a correction. Make in other words, ensure their well-being in the classroom early, and you have to deal with fewer things later in life, you hope.
Absolutely. And so there's a very large body of research that really shows the importance of early childhood. And so really thinking about age 0 to 3 and what are the types of supports needed for children in order to be successful later in life, both in terms of health and economic outcomes.
So the fifth of the five buckets we've been talking about is tax policy. This is tax policy to encourage healthy choices. What kinds of healthy choices?
So we have three different tax policies here, I think two of which will be quite familiar to your listeners, that is tobacco taxes and alcohol taxes. These have been taxes that have been implemented for many, many decades in the United States and specific localities. In Oregon, the tobacco tax is actually $3.33 per pack of cigarettes. And so this ranks seventh in the nation. And the tax on non-cigarette tobacco products is about 66% of what that cigarette tax is, which is pretty high comparatively to other states. And then the one newer tax that we're starting to see a lot of interest in, and we've seen interest at the local level on this, is sugar-sweetened beverage taxes. And so this would be taxes on products that include added sugar, because we know the impact of having added sugar on an individual's health, whether that contributes to obesity, diabetes, or other related diseases. And so we've seen a lot of states actually either pushing to incentivize localities to do this, or in some cases actually block them. And I did see that while Oregon does not have a sugar-sweetened beverage tax, voters did reject the ballot initiative a few years ago to ensure that localities and cities do have the ability to implement the tax if they would like to.
So there's a pretty clear stick here. Is there a carrot here? I mean, you talked about incentives, but what kinds of incentives can you offer people that, that would work in the other direction to incentivize them to do things that aren't smoking or aren't drinking sugary drinks?
So while it's not a policy we directly address in our report, we've seen examples of cities who have implemented a sugar-sweetened beverage tax, ensuring that other non-sugar-sweetened beverages are available up front. And so, for example, in Philadelphia, which implemented a sugar-sweetened beverage tax a few years ago, there was a significant decrease in purchasing of sugar-sweetened beverages and a significant increase in purchasing water. And that is obviously a much healthier alternative for individuals to be consuming.
So we're down to our last minute or so here, but I wanted to ask again about access to high-quality health care, which is the first of the items we talked about here. If the services are present in the community but not spread out, like into low-income areas, are there still issues with people getting to them and accessing them?
That is very true, and I think that's also why we highlight some of these other aspects. So when you think about an individual's economic standing, maybe they can't afford to be able to get to a doctor's office or be able to take the time off of work because they may not have paid sick leave in order to really get the health services that they need. We have seen increased interest in newer technologies such as telehealth services, and that's something that I think that's been utilized a lot during the COVID-19 pandemic, as physicians and hospitals have really tried to move away from in-person consultations to ensure that they are reducing the spread of COVID-19. And again, while that's not something we directly address, it is something that we're continuing to monitor to ensure that individuals do have access to high-quality health services.
Not our first conversation on healthcare, and certainly not our last. Adam Lustig is Senior Policy Development Manager at Trust for America's Health, which is out today with a new report, Leveraging Evidence-Based Policies to Improve Health, Control Costs, and Create Health Equity. We've been talking about all five of the components of it here with Adam. Adam, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.